Accession number 17747, reel 31.
Captain Cockerill, reel 30. I think you were saying that you weren't very experienced in driving left-hand drive vehicles.
That's right. Rusty at driving cars altogether, because although trained a year and a half before as a driver and quite accustomed to driving in England, I almost literally had not more than two trips driving a car since leaving Britain. We were always either driven or, in my case, I was invariably on a motorbike, leading a column or something of this kind. And so a Jeep, with its vivid acceleration and left-hand drive, was a totally different experience. It was rather like getting into a Dodgem car. I needed practice at it, which I never really got. Yes. I got a leave party off, and we the officers attended a lecture by a second in command who'd obviously been to some briefing session at division, because he told us that we were going to go to Palestine via Egypt. And I noted that I've always wanted to see the land of Kinglake's Eothen, which I had read at school. There was a party that evening in the sergeant's mess, and I bought, now at whose expense I don't know, I bought them 300 cakes as a goodwill gesture for the sergeant's mess party. But the party is chaotic and has to be broken up. Presumably, the spirits were high. 22nd March next day, our move has been put back a day, but it's delightful still to see the open fields and the lovely freshness of the atmosphere.
You mentioned that you got a warning order that you'd be going to Egypt and then on to Palestine.
It was not a warning order. It was the CO2 giving us a talk and telling us that this was going to happen. It was not.
So it wasn't formal.
It wasn't a formal thing. No. No.
But were you in any way aware of what was going on in Palestine at the time?
No way at all. We just knew that the Middle East was a land of oil fields and trouble, and that the Union Jack stood between the Middle East and chaos, or so it seemed. I mean, it was almost as broad as that. I was finding this mess secretary thing a nuisance, having to put up with an amazing amount of criticism of from different quarters. People are never satisfied about food or drink. It's universally true. I would never run a restaurant.
Well, you can't please everybody all the time.
You can't please anybody at any of the time. Seemingly. You try. I've noted that at this point, by arrangement, I split up the drink and the cutlery between the batteries. So we must have been trying to reallocate responsibility for this kind of equipment. And I've noted that quite a lot has disappeared. So it was chaos for a poor young chap trying to make sense of all of this food and cutlery and complaints.
Do you remember what sort of complaints were made?
They always took the form. I mean, it's always stemming from greed. I mean, people, you went out and foraged for eggs, for example, and you thought you'd done people proud by getting bacon and egg breakfast, and then you find that it was all complaints because they wanted two eggs, and some of them who had two eggs, they wanted three eggs. You know, it's just the self-indulgence which people sink into when they don't have anything better to think about.
So you could encourage them but never satisfy them.
That's right, exactly. Have a go tonight at the War Diary, reliving Anzio. This was a fortnight after the event. Feverishly, Thursday, 23rd, work out individual mess bills, about 70, and break up the mess after lunch. This was after having a mess just for a week.
So you were going back then, were you having battery messes?
Well, it looks like
and
it, yes.
RHQ mess.
Yes.
which would presumably be smaller and easier to handle.
I think the fact is that we were about to embark on a fortnight or more of travelling, and there was no point in trying to keep a shadow regimental mess in existence, particularly since the unit of the gunners, I think traditionally, is the battery rather than the regiment, and no doubt the battery commanders regarded this cutlery or whatever, and indeed the drink, as by shares their own and not belonging to the colonel. So work out individual mess, we'll break up the mess after lunch. The men are still convinced that we're going home.
They thought you were going back to England.
They thought we were going back to the UK. Mm.
Do you know why they got that impression?
It's triumph of hope over experience, I should think. It had been said about once a fortnight ever since Salerno. We are feeding now out of mess tins again. Long confabulations about tomorrow's move. We're issued with maps of Europe. This must have been deliberately to fox us, I should think. A sort of security move.
Might have been to fox the enemy, because if...
Well, true, yes.
If enemy agents picking up low-level gossip...
Yes.
...got the impression that your soldiers thought they were going back to the United Kingdom, then that might very well...
Yes. Yeah, absolutely
...filter
right.
up their intelligence network.
Absolutely right. I'm sure there were Italian agents of the retreating Germans around. There must have been. Yeah. I mean, even law of averages would suggest this.
Also, it occurs to me that when you were sent across the Garigliano to reconnoitre for a tactical headquarters that you didn't actually use or occupy because you went to Anzio instead.
That's right.
That might also have been connected with deception rather than simple error.
That's a good point. Yes, you mean the plans had been laid, but we were allowed to go ahead and do this thing as part of a deception. Yes.
It's conceivable.
Yes, yes, yes. I think it is. I hope you're right. What I fear is more of the cock-up theory, but I don't know.
That is also very plausible.
Yeah. Or indeed, simple change of planning. I mean, people were not expecting Anzio to turn sour in the way it did. It turned very, very sour. Mm. I don't know whether you've read much about the Anzio Bridgehead, but it was one of the supreme cock-ups of the war.
Well, there has been a lot of criticism, this is ex post facto, with hindsight, of the behaviour of Mark Clark and his...
General Lucas.
And General Lucas and so on. I mean, were you aware of any of that sort of level of thing going on at the time?
No, not at my level. Mm. I mean, no doubt brigadiers and so on must have had reservations about what was going on. Mm. We were puzzled because we couldn't understand why they had done this particular thing unless they knew that the road through to join from the Leary Valley to join up with the Anzio Bridgehead was reasonably clear and easy. And we were baffled to know why we ended up stuck up there just as sitting targets without the other people coming up through the valley. Also, of course, it had been, not promised, but there was a sort of assumption that this was a quick road to Rome and that we'd be up and over the Alban Hills in no time when we heard that this invasion had taken place. And it just didn't happen. And we know why, because the generals concerned were overcautious.
Also because they were heading for Rome, whereas the idea originally was they would head for an area north of Rome to make the city untenable rather than taking it as an objective.
Is that so? I didn't know that. You mean that the idea was to have a bridgehead north of Rome?
Yes.
Hmm. Because yes, that would have been quite a long way, wouldn't it?
If the line of withdrawal north of Rome had been menaced or cut, then the Germans would have been less inclined to hold on to it.
Yes, that's true. But it was all pie in the sky in the sense that obviously the Gustav line was a dead serious one and was not going to be penetrated.
It's stronger than anticipated.
That's right.
Yes.
Had we gone north of Rome, heaven help us, we would have been demolished, I think. There would have been no...
It's possible, but it's possible it might also have created a sense that the Gustav Line's own rear areas and communications were threatened.
Yes, yes. It would have been a battle of wills and wits between Kesselring and Mark Clark, wouldn't it?
It would.
But the longer line of reinforcement would have added, I suppose, a day to each reinforcing trip by the LSTs and
yes.
the like. A nice logistical conundrum. Yes, I hadn't thought of that. No, I didn't realise, although I must have read it, that there were plans to go north of Rome, but whatever it was, it didn't work out. It was a mess.
But you didn't realise at the time because you were too busy actually coping with the mess.
That's right. We just wondered. I mean, we were only there 3 weeks. They were three horrendous weeks, two of them in particular, the first two. It was survival that was at issue. I mean, we knew that there was a real prospect of being actually pushed into the sea or taken prisoner. Whole swathes of us. We didn't know how it was going to turn out. I mean, the Fusiliers were very hard-pressed. Morale, although as high as could be expected, must on the whole have been rather low. It's an unhappy situation to be in. But as you say, we were too preoccupied trying to stay alive and to keep them back. I think the one thing that had vanished was any thought of sort of just pushing out. I mean, it was a matter of holding what we'd got rather than going through. Because we did know that we had this half a dozen to ten divisions against us, and getting out was simply not on. However, if we go forward to the end of March, 24th of March, we're up at 4 o'clock, and we were on a train. 10:18, cold, frosty ride. Move off in cattle trucks to Taranto. It was the usual business of 40 men or 8 horses, as in North Africa.
This was the first time you'd been on the train in Italy, wasn't it?
In Italy, yes. Mm. That's right, it was.
Did it run on time?
No, it says after a hungry wait, it moved off. So presumably it didn't move on time. I'm just trying to look at the notes that I've kept, as well as the diary thing. I've only put that the train journey was followed by a short stay in a bitterly cold field at Taranto, which in earlier times had been the chief target for our fleet air arm attacking the Italian Navy.
Swordfish raid, wasn't it?
That's right. Mm. That's right.
Was Taranto in reasonable condition?
Yes.
It had been bombed, hadn't it?
It had been bombed, but it was a viable port.
What about the town around it?
Don't remember much about it.
So you went into the railway station in Taranto?
That's right. Arriving 3 p.m. and then we out again to a ghastly tented camp with a northerly gale blowing. We all felt numb. And this was, intense, that's right. Wake up 9:15 parade next morning, Saturday 25th. Take RHQ troop. You talked about how to occupy the troops. I had to take them for a route march, the signals officer. Then share a tent with signals officer, quartermaster, and a box of K rations. Otherwise, the food is terrible. Sort mail with the quartermaster and distribute the mail to the troops. On duty and on duty again, unfair, at least I thought it was unfair. Read a thriller, you talk about books, we're constantly swapping books around. Go to bed at 2 p.m, it's too cold to do anything except go to bed, camp bed of course. Trying to make up still for some of the sleep lost at Anzio. Feel depressed, partly a result of the conditions in this camp, partly a reaction after the last 6 months, which remain a vivid nightmare. I suppose it depends how sensitive you are. I was a fairly sensitive chap, and it had been a nightmare. We'd been 6 months, in effect, under enemy guns and hardly out of range of them, except for the odd day or so away. And it seemed astonishing to have survived. And I note that we are now allowed to mention Salerno and the Volturno in our letters home, but not yet Anzio.
So presumably a dispatch had been issued and the public had been informed about what had been going on.
Well, they knew, of course, from the general news about Anzio. I mean, it was not
some kind of official account might have
been. It was not a secret, but no doubt it was still subject to keeping under wraps the horrors of the place to an extent, so as not to lower morale at home. And then, an interesting thing, this is the first contact with something new. Monday the 27th, I visit the education office in Taranto for ABCA pamphlets. And this is my first mention, I think, of ABCA, which was to loom large in the next year.
It's the Army Bureau of Current Affairs.
That's right.
Yes. And had that just been set up, or did you
I'm not
know?
Sure when it was set up. I've got some of their publications still. I think it probably, I mean, it certainly didn't exist when I was a gunner in Lancashire, and I don't remember it being part of the background stuff we were expected to read at Octu. So I guess, yes, that it had come into being in the past year, sometime, possibly end of 43, this kind of thing. Though I may be quite wrong about that, but it certainly increased in frequency and intensity. They're very good. Have you seen the ABCA leaf? I mean, some of them are very good stuff. Others are slightly tending to propaganda, but on the whole, not.
You were saying that you were depressed and you were suffering a certain amount of retrospective feeling about being having been in battle.
Yes.
Did you discuss this with other officers in the regiment, or was it something you kept to yourself?
I think we each had our own thoughts. People are enormously variable. I mean, some were extroverts and had already forgotten about Anzio. Others were more introverted, like me. It's so difficult to generalise about these things, but I think I found that the people who had been students at home tended to be more introspective about these things than those who had been, it's awfully dangerous to generalise, and those who had been in jobs in the city where crisis was part of their lives, money crisis and military crisis took its place, but was sloughed off quite readily. But it's terribly dangerous to generalise. Some people were much worse affected by these things than others.
What sort of signs did they show, the ones who were badly affected? Was there anything that could be done to assist them?
I don't think so. It just had to be lived through. I don't mean anybody was on the verge of a breakdown. I don't think they were. But, people, I think, like me, probably, though I didn't know it, because we didn't swap notes on it, some people were no doubt keeping accounts of these things. Certainly they were writing them down and in their letters home, which, of course, were not seen by anybody else, because some officers' letters were not vetted.
Was it customary in the regiment to maintain a stiff upper lip and an appearance of imperturbability?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, all the motions of, tradition and all that were observed. Nobody was ever frightened.
No one ever admitted to being frightened.
No, that's right.
Were you aware of any cases of people going bomb happy within the regiment while they'd been in action in Anzio or in Salerno?
Yes, indeed. People were bomb happy in the early days in Salerno. I remember very clearly, people wandering around sobbing and that sort of thing, and having to be sent to the rear in some cases not coming back. Mm. What happened to them, I don't know, but no doubt they were treated more sympathetically than they would have been in the first war.
And so some of them actually did come back, having been...
Yes, people came back after a day or two's rest, recuperation. Mm. I mean, in some cases it was directly attributable to not just a general fear or panic, which everybody shared up to a point, but I mean, having literally seen best friends killed at the sight of them, you get an understandable grief, which is nothing to do with necessarily with panic.
Judging by the conditions you were describing, you could also expect perhaps that kind of breakdown to occur just through sheer fatigue and exhaustion.
Yes, that didn't help. We had, oddly enough, there was... I don't know what the syndrome is, the psychiatrist would no doubt identify it, but when we were in the cave in the Anzio Bridgehead, people were very reluctant to go out of it. If the cave had not been there and they'd never gone into it, this clinging to the security of the cave could never have happened.
Well, presumably if you think your safety depends upon random chance,
yes,
you just get on with what you have to do.
Yes, right.
And
that's
hope
right.
For the best. If you know that by leaving the cave you put yourself at a very great risk,
yes,
you'd naturally be reluctant to...
That's right. Yes, I didn't like being sent out of the cave again, back to my dugout in the copse up the Wadi. I've said nothing about it in my notes, but I remember feeling at the time that God was being a little unfair to send me out of the cave whilst everybody else was staying in it.
And was there an official policy on this matter propagated by the colonel or the medical officer? Because you did mention that at one point when you were outside the slit trench actually looking for the source of airburst, the colonel...
Yes, that's right. I wandered around, and it was partly to... I don't think I was... going mad or anything like that. I was trying to brace myself and think, this is life as it is in action. Just take a hold and don't panic. I was bracing myself, really. That's quite true. You're quite right to remind me of that. It was a cold... attempt to accept that I might be in any sort of condition the next day, dead or with a leg off or whatever, and one had to try to say, well, you know, this is life, this is what it's all about, and to try to accept it, try to accept the air bursts coming in.
Well, if you can't do anything about it...
That's right. I mean, either you get calm, or you go mad. I mean, there is no sense. It is a mad situation.
But it's from what you've been saying again, it seems that it was not until you were really out of danger and, you were...
The reaction sets in,
that you started getting this retrospective apprehension and anxiety.
Right. That's right.
Was there anything you could actually do to ameliorate...
Only to get back to normal by degrees. I mean, I should think this must be not dissimilar to the reaction you have after a very near miss these days on the M25.
It's almost a daily occurrence.
Almost a daily occurrence, yes, that's right. If your house sets on fire and you get out, you're going to feel, my God, what could have happened? It's this kind of quite natural retrospection. I think it's not, it wasn't serious. Although, of course, deep down, there was an element of seriousness which has gone on to this day. Not only sleep patterns, but memories of things. But one shouldn't play this up. I mean, we were young men, and you are fairly resilient. 21, 22, and you can rapidly get out of depressions, as we did.
It's often said also that young men, particularly if they're fit, have a sense of personal immortality, that no matter how much they actually are objectively in mortal danger and at risk, they always do believe that it cannot happen to them.
Yes, I don't think I'd subscribe to that. Up to a point I would. You had two levels of it. I mean, one was, but God's sake, this can't happen to me. I mean, I shall be all right. But when you are in a thing like Salerno or Anzio, and you are hearing people say, however bravely, that I've just lost my foot, or something like that, and you know damn well that it can happen to you, and that begin to regard as stupid the people who are pretending that it can't. Not that they would openly say it can't, of course, but I mean, you knew from demeanour that there were the immortals, and you knew that there were others who were only too aware that it could be their last day. So I know the generality, you know, that general view about young men feeling they're immortal, and there is something in it. I don't know whether you've read, I'll show you later, there's no point in wasting time now, there's a book well worth reading, which has a bearing on this, which I've just finished. Yes, immortality, yes. Sorry.
The other side of that is that some there are many stories of individuals having premonitions which turned out to be fulfilled. Did you ever come across any cases of that?
I don't think so, no. I mean, when I say I don't think so, it could very well have happened, but I don't think I'd have been told. I mean, people with such premonitions, unless they're very extrovert, don't usually broadcast them. They just fear in their bones. And there were times when I did not think I would come out of these things. And I was conscious enough of the rationale that I'd rather be blown to bits than have a leg blown off. I mean, this kind of thing was quite consciously thought through. I don't want to be wounded. Above all, I don't want to be painfully wounded.
Well, many soldiers say they prefer instant obliteration to mutilation. Or
Yes. Well, I think... I don't know. I think sensibly so, on the whole. It depends. I mean, I've met many men since without a leg or without an arm who have adjusted well to it, and perhaps it was over pessimistic to rather be dead than having only one arm. But on the other hand, Richmond Hill, the Star and Garter, there are people who have been there more or less since the first war, and who would wish that on anyone?
Also in Brookwood there are
another
thing that's often said is that certain weapons generated rather more anxiety than others. I mean, were you particularly concerned by any specific
weapon? Because the noise, Werther. Yes, that's undeniably the most frightening thing. I mean, it had the noise of death about it, coming screaming down towards you.
So it's the noise rather than the actual physical
effect. I think the most difficult thing to convey about military action is noise. You see films about, the Americans capturing islands in the Pacific and this and that action during the war. And they're fine, they're very realistic, but they do not have the noise, the overwhelming noise of guns going off at the side of you, the bombs dropping, is so much greater than any recording equipment like a television set would stand.
Well, it would be physically damaging, wouldn't it?
That's right.
The real volume of noise, if you could reproduce it.
Precisely.
In itself would be extremely difficult.
It is horrendously noisy, war. And I think I've had to remind myself of this sometimes, as well as telling it to other people, that you can never get into the reality of this without the noise. How it would be to a deaf person, I don't know. But the noise is the missing factor in reality attempts.
And I think we'd left you preparing to hand your vehicles over and kit in and go off to Egypt.
That's right. Yes. There was a officers' club in Taranto, went for tea there with signals officer and then to an all-Italian show. Very amusing. I remember this very well, because the chorus, the girls in the chorus were all pregnant. but I remember Colonel Zambra, very scathing about this. The girls being very amused.
Well, about the girls being pregnant?
Yes, pregnant poorly trained as dancers and with all their kit astray. I remember you saying, good God, look at that, you can see her bush. I remember that's the only thing I can remember Colonel Zambra for, poor man.
This was a variety show, was it?
Yes, that's right.
Music and dancing.
Yes.